Blog Talk Radio.
Depleted uranium.
and on the accident in the nuclear accident in Fukushima.
Mm-hmm.
And this lady is an expert on both, and she's going to be talking about. She's going to be bringing in her view on that. It's going to be, I don't know, it's 20 to 30 minute interview, so be fascinating. And so looking forward to that. So we got a big night planned ahead.
So
and,
let's begin with some news, shall we, Leo?
Yeah, this was an English article, but it relates to what we're doing in the United States with this crazy-ass war that we just started. It says, Rothschild globalist killers pour depleted uranium on Libyans in nuclear war. And so what do they know that is so secret? They are all guilty of war crimes, knowing they have all authorized the use of weapons of mass destruction against innocent civilians and our own military forces to a level bordering on mass genocide. Many of the weapons used, especially those used against tanks, armor-piercing, and those used against hard targets, which are cruise missiles and bunker busters, all contain uranium components, such as penetrators, shaped charged liners, and a counterweight, most of which is made up of depleted uranium. And all weapons that contain depleted uranium weapons are recognized as radioactive poison gas weapons and thus violate the Geneva Convention under the 1925 Geneva Poison Gas Protocol. And this is from Rents.com.
These weapons are described as highly mobile, indiscriminate killer in permanent terrain containment, which
contaminant,
which has a half-life of 4.5 billion years and thus remain in the environment forever. The airflow chart below, which you can't see, demonstrates how the depleted uranium gas and dust is widely circulated in many directions depending on altitude and seasonal changes, including fog, rainfall, snow, and air circulation.
So I've
added a white square over the current conflict zone in Libya, and it's very easy to see how this violates the Geneva Convention and how this airflow chart, high concentrations of radioactive particles end up in the atmosphere over Scandinavia, UK, Spain, Portugal, France, Holland, Germany, Italy, Greece, Turkey, Romania, Bulgaria, Eastern and Central Europe. Another weather system also made sure that the entire Middle East was also contaminated. Afghanistan, Asia, and Southeast Asia, with some particles delivered to China, Taiwan, Korea, Japan, and by express delivery on the jet stream, then moved over to the northern USA and the rest of the world. We must also put an emphasis on the fact that when it comes to low-pressure areas or monsoonal flows, the containment comes back to Earth, permanently contaminate the soil and water in the respective regions.
Yeah, the contamination comes back to Earth.
Yeah,
but,
a classic example of proof that the level of contamination at any given location can be alarmingly high is shown in the graph below, which you can see.
Where the spikes on the chart coincide with heavy periods of bombing in areas of conflict, one can clearly see is when we look at the original U.S.-led shock and awe attack on Baghdad at the beginning of the Gulf War. Please understand that the atmosphere over and around an area covering from Reading through to London received an extremely high dose of radioactive nanoparticles that can and will impact on the health of those people who live below its deadly cloud. The graph below states it. So, and shows that it's quite, look at the contaminant.
Yeah.
Jeez. This happened all in London. And the Iraq, I remember when that happened, too.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when that cloud went over Europe.
This all refers to that. But
yeah.
The existing UN Security Council is totally out of date with the current world, and such decisions should, I'm not sure what that would be.
Made by the UN General Assembly based on the majority vote. So
the existing system is totally corrupt and certainly controlled by the New World Order, which is the international political arm of the New World Order and backed up by its military arm, being that of NATO.
And the thing goes on.
This is an extremely long article.
Yeah, but interesting in that it was, where was it from anyway? People
mm-hmm.
go to. Yeah. Rothschild Global School of Sport, DU on Libyans in
by Peter Iyer.
Yeah. So runs.com. And
it's really disgraceful.
Yeah. Yeah, so.
Radiation.
Yeah, this was devastating.
1,600 times normal level, 20 kilometers from Fukushima plant. Radiation 1,600 times higher than normal levels has been detected in an area about 20 kilometers from the crippled Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant, International Atomic Energy Agency officials said on Monday. Oh, dear.
Pretty bad.
Only takes a minute to get the rest of this article up. Oh, as much as I love technology, it can sometimes be really slow. And this is from Kyoto News.
No. Yeah. Okay.
Data collection by an IAEA team shown that radiation levels of a 161 microsievert per hour have been detected in the town of Naomi, Fukushima Prefecture, the officials said. The government set an exclusion zone covering areas within 20-kilometer radius of the plant and has urged people within 20 to 30 kilometers to stay indoors.
A 1,600 times the normal level.
I can't imagine what that'll do to people.
Yeah, I mean, that's a sick stuff.
Radiation protection.
No, this is the one that, this is a really long one, remember?
Mm-hmm.
The one that goes into all the technical jargon, so I'll pass on that one. If anybody's really interested, though, I'd recommend this article.
Tell them who it's by.
It's by the fortifyhealth.com. Okay? Fortifyhealth.com. And it's a fascinating article, and it's very long, but it tells you radiation protection now and long term, and it goes into all the details on how to protect yourself if you happen to live on the West Coast or in any of these contaminated areas. And so the West Coast of the United States is now under a heavy plume of radiation from the Japanese thing. So now this one here is interesting because it's about time, and I'm grateful that they won. Bloomberg filed a lawsuit against the Federal Reserve back in 2008 to release where all of their money, who got paid off in the bailouts. Okay, and the Supreme Court finally did something right and agreed with Bloomberg.
The Federal Reserve will disclose details of emergency loans it made to banks in 2008 after the U.S. Supreme Court rejected an industry appeal that aimed to shield the records from public view. The justices today left intact a court order that gives the Fed 5 days to release the records sought by Bloomberg News' parent company, Bloomberg LP. The Clearinghouse Association, LLC, a group of the nation's largest commercial banks, had asked the Supreme Court to intervene. The board will fully cooperate with the court's decision and is preparing to make the information available, said David Skidmore, a spokesman for the Fed. The order marks the first time a court has forced the Fed to reveal the names of banks that borrowed from its oldest lending program, the 98-year-old discount window. The disclosures, together with details of 6 bailout programs released by the central bank in December under congressional mandate, would give taxpayers insight into the Fed's unprecedented $3.5 trillion effort to stem the 2008 financial panic. I can't recall that the Fed was ever sued and forced to release information in its 98-year history, said Alan H. Meltzer, the author of 3 books on the U.S. central bank and a professor at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh.
Carnegie Mellon is one of the Mellon Bank is one of the
bailed out.
It's one of the Federal Reserve banks. Okay, which is interesting. But unprecedented disclosure, and under the trial, judge's order, the Fed must reveal 231 pages of documents relating to borrowers in April and May 2008, along with loan amounts. Fox News is pressing a bid for 6,186 pages of similar information on loans made from August 07 to November 08. Now, that would be interesting.
The records were originally requested under the Freedom of Information Act, which allows citizens access to government papers by the late Bloomberg News reporter Mark Pittman. As the financial crisis developed in 2007, the Federal Reserve forgot that it is the central bank of the people of the United States and not a private academy where decisions of great importance may be withheld from public scrutiny, said Matthew Winkler, editor-in-chief of Bloomberg News. The Fed must be accountable to Congress, especially in disclosing what it does with the people's money. The Clearinghouse Association contended that Bloomberg is seeking an unprecedented disclosure that might dissuade banks from accepting emergency loans in the future. Yeah, right.
An Obama administration, for some of the quotes, we are disappointed that the court has declined our petitions, which deal with the protection of highly confidential bank information provided by the Federal Reserve, the group said in a statement after the High Court acted. A federal trial judge ruled in 2009 that the Fed had to disclose the records in the Bloomberg case, and a New York-based appeals court upheld that ruling. The Clearinghouse Association's chances to get a Supreme Court hearing suffered a setback when the Obama administration urged the justices not to hear the appeal. Now, this Obama is such a freaking piece of crap, and the government said that underlying issues had limited practical significance because Congress last year laid out new rules for disclosing Fed loans in the Dodd-Frank law.
Yeah. Congress has resolved the question of whether and when the type of information at issue in this case must be disclosed. In the future, the administration said in a brief filed by Acting Solicitor General Neil Katyal. President Barack Obama's top Supreme Court lawyer.
Katyal.
Yeah, what a funny name.
Discount
window. The Fed had previously fought alongside the banks in opposing disclosures. It also sought to join the industry group in seeking high court review, only to be overruled by Katyal, according to court documents.
Justice Elena Kagan, formerly Obama's top Supreme Court lawyer, didn't take part in the court's decision of the appeal. Right. She recused herself of over 25 different cases, you know.
Yeah, good for her.
Since joining the court last year, she has disqualified herself from cases in which she took part as a government lawyer. And Bloomberg initially requested similar information for aid recipients under three other federal emergency plans, and the central bank released details for those facilities and others in December after Congress required disclosures through Dodd-Frank law. The legislation didn't apply retroactively to the discount window lending program, which provides short-term funding to financial institutions. And discount window loans are made after July 21st, 2010, must be released following a two-year lag.
Fortunately, Congress was well aware of the sensitivity of disclosing this information, the Clearinghouse Association said in its statement. As part of the Dodd-Frank Act, Congress adopted a specific rule to ensure that in the future this confidential information will not be disclosed prematurely to the detriment of our financial system. Yeah, right. The New York-based Clearinghouse Association, which has processed payments among banks since 1853, includes Bank of America North America, Banker of New York Mellon, Citibank North America, Deutsche Bank Trust Company, Americas, HSBC Bank USA North America, JP Morgan Chase Bank North America, U.S. Bank North America, and Wells Fargo Bank North America.
These are all Federal Reserve banks.
In trying to shield the documents from disclosure, the clearinghouse involved a Freedom of Information Act exemption that covers trade secrets and a commercial or financial information obtained from a person and privileged or confidential. The cases are Clearinghouse Association versus Bloomberg and Clearinghouse Association versus Fox News. To contact the reporter on this story, which you could do, go to George Store in Washington at gstore@bloomberg.net.
you can get this article from right on Bloomberg. Just go to Bloomberg.com, Bloomberg News. Okay. Yeah, I thought that was important.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just...
So that appointee, Elena Kagan, hasn't been much help.
Yeah, you know what makes me laugh? I gotta tell you what makes me laugh. Every time you look at the name, the way you'd think the news reporters around the world would get Gaddafi's name correct. Okay? Now, Gaddafi, I've seen spelt with a K, and I've seen spelt with a G, all right? And I've seen spelt with a Q, all right?
Well, I don't know what you said.
Everybody's got their own tag on this. And Gaddafi, this particular one, MoxNews.com, saw that K-H-A-D-D-A-F-Y. I just saw one on CNN who spelled it G-H-A-D-D-A-F-Y. Okay? And if you go into any
probably an Arab newspaper would be the best.
Yeah, the Arabs. Yeah. The Arabs go by...
Al Jazeera probably have the correct spelling.
Q. Yeah. So it's like Americans spell the Quran with a K, you know? Whereas the Arabs spell it with a Q. But anyway, the surprising peanut. We only got about 10 minutes. I wanted to make sure I played this one, this video. This is one on the benefits, the incredible medical benefits of marijuana. It's about 5 minutes long. I'd like to play that right now. Is that
okay?
Ready? As by Dr. Donald Taskin, M.D., professor of pulmonary medicine at UCLA. And this is a YouTube video. So you're obviously just going to hear the... And there's several other people involved in this video as well. Listen to the incredible medical benefits of marijuana.
It's truly amazing... the number of conditions that respond favorably to cannabis.
It heals in any circumstance with any condition. We're looking at an unexcelled wonder plant, herbal medicine that has no comparison.
Cannabis is found in every major materia medica that has ever been written. It was included in the United States Pharmacopeia from 1854 until 1941. The founder of modern medicine is a physician named Sir William Osler, who was prominent around the turn of the 19th to 20th century. He wrote the first textbook of internal medicine, and in that textbook, he said that cannabis was the most effective medication for the treatment of migraine headaches. The first modern research that was done on cannabis was done in 1949 that demonstrated its usefulness in treating epilepsy. I have a number of people who don't have epilepsy when they use cannabis regularly.
Cannabis is remarkably well suited to our anatomy and physiology, even in the event one smokes it.
Marijuana was widely used in the 19th century for the treatment of asthma. And in the 1970s, we found that marijuana has a bronchodilator effect. It's because of the THC in marijuana. What is the evidence that marijuana smoking, habitual marijuana smoking, can lead to lung cancer? With respect to the development of lung cancer, we found no evidence of any increased risk of lung cancer occurrence in association with marijuana smoking alone. The THC actually has an anti-tumor effect. And these are studies that were done both in experimental animals and in cell culture systems and for different kinds of cancer. For lung cancer, breast cancer, thyroid cancer, prostate cancer, gliomas, brain cancer, that the development and growth, or the growth actually of the tumor is suppressed by THC, and metastases are also suppressed.
There was a study done on AIDS patients by Dr. Donald Abrams of UCSF to specifically determine whether or not the use of cannabis had an adverse effect on AIDS patients. And rather than finding that it had an adverse effect, he found that it had a favorable effect and that it counteracted AIDS wasting syndrome. Cannabis is useful in relieving people's pain. People are able to decrease the amount of opiates that they're taking and in some instances to stop taking opiates entirely for pain control.
Antioxidant, anti-inflammatory, smooth muscle relaxant. It's also an antispasmodic.
It's particularly effective in relieving pain from connective tissue disorders, from arthritis, from fibromyalgia, from systemic lupus, from reflex sympathetic dystrophy, a whole host of conditions that we don't really understand very well. People seem to get good relief from cannabis.
From a medical viewpoint, cannabis has no overdose potential.
It's helpful in dealing with the anxiety of people that have Alzheimer's disease. It's helpful in dealing with the muscle spasms that are associated with Parkinson's disease.
Cannabis has an unexcelled record in terms of providing safe and effective sleep.
We did a little study of people with Crohn's disease and found that many of them were able to stop using steroids and stop using other medications that they had taken for their Crohn's, that they had less diarrhea, they had less abdominal pain. It was a true miracle for them.
Here you have a substance that makes you feel better, has an overdose potential, returns you to your cognitive level of functioning.
We've got 15,000 studies that have been done, both basic science and clinical studies, that have demonstrated over and over again the medicinal value of cannabis. I think there's a very bright future for medical cannabis in this country.
It certainly has a lot of uses, doesn't it,
to
alleviate a lot of pain, kind of pain.
Medical cannabis and its impact on human health. That's
amazing
on YouTube.
What it can.
And it's put out by THC Creative Media. THCCreativeMedia.com. I highly recommend it.
It has a broad number of uses. I was very surprised.
And there's a full doc. This is just a trailer, but there's a full documentary on this at marijuanamovie.org. Marijuanamovie.org.
So you can listen to the complete.
Yeah.
You know, what all of the uses are for. We just, you know, they talked about migraine headaches to fibromyalgia, but there must be many other uses, too.
Yeah, that's great. So we have our guest coming up in a few minutes. They haven't called in quite yet, so let's move on to something. That was quite a tragic pill.
What was that, Leo?
This is about the Japan crisis. There's no food. To tell people there is no food, says this man. The unshaven man in a track suit stops his bicycle on the roadside and glances over his shoulder to check that he is unobserved. Satisfied, he reaches quickly into the sludge-filled gutter, picks up a discarded ready meal, and stuffs it into a plastic carrier bag. In another time, another place, Kazuhiro Takahashi could be taken for a tramp out scavenging for food after a long night in the bottle. In fact, he is just another hungry victim of Japan's tsunami trying to find food for his family. He said, "I am so ashamed," says the 43-year-old construction worker after he realizes he has been spotted. "But for 3 days, we haven't had enough food. I have no money because my house was washed away by the tsunami and the cash machine is not working." Hang on a second. This is by Telegraph UK, by the way. It is, if his haul wasn't so pitiful, his bag had 2 packets of defrosted prawn dumplings and a handful of vacuum-packed seafood sticks inside. Mr. Tishahashi might be taken for a looter. But in the park town of Ikunamaki, 200 miles north of Tokyo, his story is disturbingly common. Japan might be a rich country, but a week after the tsunami struck, it is struggling to feed and house the victims adequately.
I have a place in a rescue center in the Akai Elementary School, but the food they are giving us is not enough, said Mr. Takahashi. Says, my parents are in their 70s, and we receive a tiny bowl of plain rice twice a day with nothing else, just a pinch of salt. We are hungry, so we have to come look for food. Mr. Takahashi is not alone. Over his shoulder, a small legion of tramps, their feet wrapped in plastic bags, can be seen, trawling the muddy aisles of smashed-up supermarkets, hoping to find other edible treasures that might supplement rescue center rations. Don't take my photograph, boxed the man in blue overalls with at least 3 days stubble on his chin. This is so shaming, but I have given up on the government. We cannot rely on them, so we have to help ourselves. Shame plays an important role in Japanese society, forcing people to maintain their outward norm of life even faced with the most extreme of circumstances, as the world has witnessed to its amazement this past week. But in Ichiomaki and countless other stricken towns along the country's northeast coast, raw necessity is starting to fray even Japanese super-taut social fabric. There are no longer Japanese, says one woman bystander with a shiver of pity and disdain. I don't feel like this is Japan.
Okay.
And we have our caller on.
Our guest is here. And maybe we'll have time to go back to this article. It's very, very good. But the people in Japan, many of them are starving, so it's not as good as you think.
Our caller is on the air now.
Yes.
Good evening. Is this Richard?
Hello, it sure is. Hello. How are you today?
We're great. Thank you. How are you?
Very, very good.
And we want to mention quickly before we forget that you're going to soon be out in our area in person. Are you here now in Hartford, Connecticut?
Yeah, I'm very excited about that. We're going to be out there Saturday, March 26th, all day.
Mm-hmm.
It's 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., which is quite an ordeal.
Is that all representatives from architects and engineers, or will there be people from other organizations at that meeting?
Many different organizations, in fact, family members, experts, researchers. This is all about World Trade Center Building 7, which we'll be talking about today, the third skyscraper to collapse on 9/11 that hardly anybody knows about.
Oh, absolutely. And since you've mentioned that, why don't we start right there with your telling us about that and refreshing people's memories here, our listeners.
Well, sure.
Go ahead,
Leo.
No, that's okay. Go ahead.
I don't know if you had a chance to introduce me or not to your listeners.
Okay. You've been adequately introduced, but...
Thank you for that.
And you mentioned who you are yourself
as well.
And how
you got involved with this as well, so people know your story, maybe, would be a good way to start.
Say it again, Leo.
I said... In case, if you were, you know, you might want to start by just introducing yourself or how you got involved in the architecture.
Oh, sure. Four years ago, I've been an architect for 23 years. 4 years ago, I was on my way to a construction site observation, and I heard on the free speech radio out here David Ray Griffin, researcher. Author of 9 books, he was talking about all of this evidence that I hadn't heard anything about, including this third skyscraper that collapsed. I was just flabbergasted. I did some research, found out what he was saying was true, and I was shocked. There were no other architects and engineers speaking about this publicly, really. So I followed in the footsteps of the scholars for 9/11 truth and the pilots for 9/11 truth and veterans for 9/11 truth. Now there's about 24 of these organizations calling for a new investigation. So I showed this presentation, the PowerPoint presentation I put together, to the firm I worked for at the time. All 15 architects thought I was nuts beforehand. Afterward, they all agreed with me that, oh, my God, you're right. I didn't know about any of this stuff. These are explosive controlled demolitions. And so they signed my petition. And that was 4 years ago with 15 petition signers. Now we have over 1,460 architects and engineers across the country, technical, verified professionals, calling for the new investigation. Most of them know nothing about this third skyscraper, Building 7. It was a football field a length away from the Twin Towers. And on 9/11, at about 5:20 in the afternoon, this skyscraper that wasn't hit by an airplane, had a few small fires in it, began suddenly to collapse straight down uniformly, symmetrically, into its own footprint almost, and at free fall acceleration. In other words,
and not
it
only
dropped.
That, but, yeah, that was supposed to be the safest building in New York City. That was where Giuliani's safety bunker was supposed to be, you know? Unbelievable.
His bunker was in the 23rd floor of that building, and it was highly reinforced. But the building itself was robustly engineered, five times stronger than it needed to be to resist any kind of a collapse. And it fell as fast as a bowling ball dropping off the side of the building. And then the bowling ball, it falls at free fall acceleration because the only force acting on it is gravity, and that's a downward force. There is no resistance underneath it, save, you know, air, which is negligible. The building had 40,000 tons of structural steel framework in it, designed to resist such a fall. So how could a building fall that fast for at least 100 feet of its fall? Unless the columns and the are removed, and that can only be done explosively, and it has to be done in a timed, synchronistic manner, where they are taken out within a tenth of a second of each other, or so on each floor. And if there's any deviation in that pattern in the controlled demolition industry, that happens, and buildings will begin to tip over. This is a very precise science that fire, the official cause of this building's collapse, cannot accomplish. So this is one of the main reasons the architects and engineers are calling for a new investigation, and it is the key smoking gun because it is so visually and intuitively understandable as a controlled demolition. We've all seen these in old hotels, for instance, like in Las Vegas. So there's a lot more evidence, though, that supports the hypothesis here of explosive controlled demolition over the hypothesis of fire.
You know, I have to mention this because back in 2004, we were the very first radio show to have David Ray Griffin on in the country. And
talking about his book,
The New Pearl Harbor,
when it first was published.
Right, and he couldn't get
a bus ticket.
No, that night he was retiring from Claremont College. All right, and he gave his last lecture, and then he did the interview from his office at the college. And they had sent out over 500, his publisher had sent out over 500 books to all the major media outlets in the country, radio shows and television shows and major newspapers and stuff like that. He couldn't get any interviews, nothing. Okay, until the first interview he got, which I wound up reading, was the San Francisco Chronicle. And I saw that on a website, and immediately called him, all right, and called his publicist, rather, got him on the air. And she told me that she had sent over 500 books out and over the course of 3 or 4 months and didn't get one reply. And mine was the very first media reply as far as a radio show. So we were pleased to find out. And then when I got the book and read it, I was blown away.
Just like you were.
Just like you were.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, David was...
He laid out the case.
Yeah, and
so
a fun thing was, the amazing thing was, is that he was so impressed by the reaction. He was following his Amazon ratings, you know. And he emailed me back, and he said he couldn't believe how many people or how big a jump he got in his Amazon ratings for the night of our show. And I was, and from that, he was then able to. Then he started getting calls from other radio shows until, and then
he really took off.
And then I introduced him to Eileen. I told Eileen Proctor about him.
And for those of you who don't know, Eileen is a publicist.
She's a publicist, yeah.
Out in California.
And she, in turn, told Jimmy Walters, who was Mr. 911, all right, and doing a huge tour throughout Europe and the United States, even, to expose 9/11, joined in 2005, actually. And then, I guess you came along in 2006. David Griffin, then he kind of exploded. His book took off, and he became the spokesman for 911 for quite a while. And
he's doing a fantastic job.
Put out a number of many different other books on it. I'm so pleased and so proud that his work got out there, because if nothing more, that was a book that had to be read, you know.
Well, I recommend your listeners look at one of his latest books, The Mysterious Collapse of World Trade Center 7, because that's what we're talking about today. And in it, he documents the official story and how it can't possibly be true. For instance, the NIST says there's massive fires in this building, and yet the videos and photos show only a few small isolated pockets of fire. And they say the initiation of this building, its collapse, started on floor 12 in this large fire, and yet the photos and videos show that the fires on that floor were burned out. So the entire, by an hour before the building collapsed. So this pulls the rug out from alone underneath NIST's official theory. They focus on column 79 in the northeast corner as being the failure point, because the east penthouse up above fails first about 6 seconds prior to the overall collapse. So they fabricate this incredible story of thermal expansion pushing, expanding these 50-foot-long beams, which push the girder off of its seat on column 79. Causing an internal failure of 9 floors pancaking down, progressive collapse. And in a redundantly designed building like this, no one of the steps that they outline could possibly have even happened. And even if they did, there wouldn't be the internal failure of the inside of the building, which would... Because without telegraphing that failure in massive warping and indentation on the outside of the building prior to its collapse, their own computer animations show what would have happened if their theory were true, that there would have been this massive warping. And yet that's not what we see at all in the videos. It's a straight down, uniform, sudden collapse. So the official story is they pull the rug out from underneath themselves with this. In addition, there are first responders that hear sounds of explosions at the onset of this building. And there's through Freedom of Information Act, there's videos that have come forth that support that. And explosions, of course, are what we'd be looking for, because there would be cutter charges going off in this building. What we find in the base of Building 7 is, and the Twin Towers, by the way, is pools of molten iron. The first responders and structural engineers and cleanup workers call it molten steel, flowing like lava, they said. This is incredible. I mean, this material takes 2,700 degrees minimum to begin to melt. And fires can only get about half that hot. And jet fuel, too, by the way, is just a hydrocarbon. So where are the temperatures coming from to create this massive these massive quantities of molten iron, as the chemical analysis shows it to be molten iron? Well, we also find molten iron in all the World Trade Center dust in the form of these small spheres that are only the diameter of a human hair, billions of them, up to 6% of the weight of the finely pulverized concrete powder, which is another issue, but comprising this dust, up to 6% of the weight is molten iron spheres. Well, how would they get there in all the dust throughout lower Manhattan? Well, if there were thousands of cutter charges throughout these buildings and under explosive conditions, the byproduct of thermite, which is an incendiary used by the military to cut through steel like a hot knife through butter, the byproduct is liquid molten iron, because thermite is composed of aluminum powder and iron oxide. And so when it ignites, it produces massive quantities of molten iron. Now, up in the buildings, if there were explosions also, it would atomize that liquid because of the pressure, and the droplets would form themselves into spheres like raindrops or like spraying water out of a bottle. And this cools and falls with all of the dust. So this is the only rational explanation for all of these spheres, and it's consistent with the pools of molten iron seen by the first responders and the extremely hot temperatures documented by many people, including organizations, including Bechtel, OSHA.
Larry Silverstein, the owner of those buildings, the World Trade Center and Building 7, mm-hmm. All right, went on public broadcasting, okay, it was on the documentary that was done shortly after, okay, on a television show, saying that he ordered them to be pulled. He ordered and I saw the video. I saw him saying it. All right, and he never denied that. Okay, and he said it right there in that program. All right, and then he said the fire department said, "Oh, there's a fire, and we want to pull the building." And he said, "Yeah, please go ahead."
Let's be clear about what he said and didn't say. What he said was he was talking with the chief, and they said, well, maybe there's been such terrible loss of life, maybe the smartest thing to do is pull it. And so they gave the order to pull, and we watched the building come down.
Right.
Most people interpret that as an order to pull, or in a controlled demolition, the word pull is used for that purpose.
In which they use.
Right.
What Larry Silverstein came back and said is that, well, that's not what I meant. I meant to pull the firemen out of the building, and
make
sense, because the firemen weren't in the building putting the fire out. They were told not to go in there and put the fire out, as a matter of fact.
Right. In fact, the amazing thing was, too, is that not only did he lie about that after he admitted it, all right, but the amazing thing about that was the there was a BBC video, I don't know if you saw it or not, a BBC newscast, a woman reporter, who 10 minutes before the building collapsed, okay, reported
on
it.
Let me tell the story. It was 5 o'clock, 20 minutes before the building collapsed. The BBC reports, this is Jane Stanley, she reports the collapse of World Trade Center 7 actually 20 minutes before it happened. The BBC apologized for this grievous error, citing the confusing events of the day. But does that make them psychic? What's going on here is the question. There was foreknowledge is what you're getting at.
Tremendous foreknowledge. And the fact that anybody could, that those buildings could be demolished so quickly and so efficiently within, 20, less than 4 or 5 hours, okay, that particular building was demolished. When it takes 2 or 3 months to prepare the demolition of a building like that.
Yeah, that's for sure. And that's how they knew about it, because it was done in advance. CNN announced the collapse of this building actually at 11:07. They said a fireman came by at 10:45 saying that there was a massive 50-story building that collapsed also. And yet there was no 50-story building that collapsed. The Twin Towers had already collapsed. He wasn't talking about them. So the question is, was this building supposed to come down earlier in the morning? Had it come down, we might never have seen it on video, because it would have been completely obscured by the massive dust clouds from the Twin Towers that had just come down.
The other thing that, fascinated me was that that building not only was Giuliani's
bunker,
but it also housed the CIA offices, FBI, CIA, government offices, and all of the thousands upon thousands of documents for the Enron trial that was coming up. All right?
Yeah, there's a lot of reason to be suspicious here.
A lot of conveniences for that reason, for that building to go down the way it did.
And the buildings were all full of asbestos and impossible to rehab.
Okay.
To say that
well,
was
building seven. Yeah, Building 7 wasn't full of asbestos, but the Twin Towers were. There was a real financial problem there being faced by the owners, Larry Silverstein, as you mentioned, who was being forced to take the asbestos out of the buildings,
right,
just like other high-rises in the area. But what's of greatest concern also to the 1,460 architects and engineers is the documentation in Building 7 of the one piece of steel that they did manage to save. The other 99.9% of the steel in World Trade Center 7 was illegally shipped off to China at a rate of 400 truckloads a day. This is completely illegal, and the fire protection engineers were up in arms about it. But the one piece of steel they saved was highly documented in their Appendix C, the FEMA's Appendix C of their BPAT, Building Performance Assessment Report, in May of 2002. What did they document? High temperature corrosion, a hot sulfur corrosion attack on the steel, which melted it and made it look like Swiss cheese as well. So there's melting of steel beams documented by structural engineers, and now the hot sulfur corrosion attack. Well, what does that mean? Well, sulfur is added to thermite to make it become thermate, much more highly effective in cutting through steel. This is the only rational explanation for the presence of sulfur in the debris pile, that it was put there in order to cut through the steel, because that's exactly what it did. It didn't come from the gypsum board, because sulfur doesn't leach out of the gypsum board and attack the steel that it's designed to protect. So that's critical evidence. Also, in the World Trade Center dust, scientists, a small team, found small red-gray chips of this curious substance. They're red on one side and gray on the other, about a 16th of an inch long. In all four samples this international team studied, these come up to the magnet because of the iron content. So we have iron particles and aluminum particles that are 1,000 times smaller than the human hair, embedded in this organic matrix of carbon and silica. What is iron and aluminum powders, once again? It's the components of thermite. They're intimately mixed and proportioned in 1/4-3/4 ratio to make up thermite. And there's speculated to be up to 10 tons of this unignited nanothermite composite material, which can be engineered to be explosive. This should not be found in the World Trade Center dust. It's documented very carefully in the Bentham Open Chemical Physics Journal.
You seem to have, and of course we realize that you have lots of evidence that this didn't happen the way the government officially said that it did. So what headway are you making into reopening any kind of hearing with all this documented evidence and analysis that you have behind you?
Well, what? What, Leah? Okay. We have a delay. Sorry. Let me answer the question then. We have been making headway. We're doing an interview, a radio interview, almost every day now in anticipation of our Hartford event at the Millard Auditorium at the University of Hartford this Saturday. We're also doing a 10-city tour to raise awareness in the public in throughout the Midwest. So there's lots of traveling, lots of speaking engagements, lots of interviews. We've given our DVD to every member of Congress now, along with a packet of information, and we're following up on those. Do we have a congressperson pushing for us to get an investigation yet? No. That will be very important, but they seem to be avoiding this issue, as we discussed a little earlier, like the plague, just like the mainstream media is. It's not a popular subject. It's going to take a groundswell of public outrage to require them to do anything.
Well, recently, commission members have come out and said that that they there was a whitewash. Have you been in contact with any of those people?
Or have they been in contact with you?
There's been some contacts with members of the 9/11 Truth Movement and all the commissioners, and they're not jumping in with both feet, that's for sure. One of them quit the commission during the investigation, Max Cleland, citing that it was a national scandal. The investigation is now compromised, he said. Others have, like John Farmer, the chief counsel from the 9/11 commission, said there was an agreement at some point not to tell the truth. He couldn't believe how far from the truth the 9/11 commission report was. Others stated that they were set up to fail. They were lied to by the Bush administration and the CIA and the Air Force. So there's lots of reasons for a new investigation.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And, I wanted to...
Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention actually, I forgot my question. But, I'm sorry.
So is your goal to convince at least one member of Congress to try to get a new commission opened?
At least. We'd like several, and if we can't get any action in Congress, we are looking at international bodies who are capable of providing a truly independent investigation with subpoena power. It's very complicated, and we're architects and engineers, not investigators, so we certainly need a lot of help from the community.
What international body would that be in particular?
There's a number of the International Crimes Tribunal, the International Court, the UN, the Hague. There's bodies that do these kinds of things. I haven't researched them personally.
Okay.
You know, I did want to mention that there were. I'm very, very glad that that your organization is moving this forward some more. But I guess what happened to the original investigators in this, which were authors like Jim Mars, who wrote The Terror Conspiracy,
mm-hmm.
Authors like Webster Tarpley, and motivators like Alex Jones and others. I don't see them getting they've been so marginalized and so beat up by their work, they've had to step back a bit. Okay, and I'm so glad that you guys took over, and you know, the technical people, architects, engineers, and so on, and pushed forward. But have you had any involvement at all with Jim Mars or Webster Tarpley or Christopher Bolin or any of these people who were the original investigators on the on 9/11?
Yeah, I've met all of them, and I've spoken on Alex Jones' show about five times.
Right.
I think it's a pretty tight community, and in general, we all worked together fairly well.
That's good. That's good.
Well, it's wonderful work that you're doing. I so hope that you can make an impact on someone from Congress or the government that will have a new investigation so that the truth will finally come out. I think the American people deserve it, and I think those victims deserve the truth. Their families certainly do.
And I wish you a lot of success in your tour, and especially I hope everything turns out well for you here in Hartford. We're actually in Salisbury.
Not too far from there.
But we hope we wish you the very best, Richard, and all your crew.
Thanks. I hope to meet you, and I encourage your listeners to look at our website, which is AE911truth.org. That's AE for Architects and Engineers, 911truth.org. You can watch the DVD online and see all of the evidence that we haven't had a chance to talk about today.
Right.
Well, we thank you very much, and I know many of our listeners will go to that site. And once again, thank you for the good work that you're doing to bring out the truth.
Yes.
Oh, you're very, very welcome. Thank you so much, and we'll catch up with you soon.
All right.
Okay.
Good night.
Good night.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was Richard Gage talking to us about what happened to Building 7 during the 911. So let's go to In the Ring with Woody, and we'll play his music.
Lila, that music always seems like it goes on forever. Anyway.
It wakes you up anyway.
It certainly does. Good evening, sports fans. Watch your heads on the ropes as you step into the ring with Woody. Tonight's topics, Mellow Mellows, Bonds Up, and Ollie Out. Okay, let's get down to it. New Nick Carmelo Anthony revealed before a loss to Milwaukee, that a clear-the-air film session was held in Nick's Milwaukee hotel room, during which he told his mates to be patient with him and not to expect him ever again to get that frustrated on the court as he did on Friday in Detroit. Carmelo hit on the bus following Friday's loss in Detroit without talking to the media. Anthony almost never talks before a game, but did this after the game to make up for his blow-off after his awful 2-of-12 six-point showing. During the loss, Anthony had bad body language, failed to join the huddle, and at one juncture kind of yapped at fellow teammate Douglas for not getting a low post feed. According to Anthony, what I was frustrated about was neither here nor there. That day is over with. He went on to say he was happy he got the chance to talk with Coach and the guys, letting him know don't used to be me be getting frustrated out there. All around, it was just a bad day, you know, along with us losing. The way we lost, that stuff is frustrating. Late Friday night, Amari Stoudemire called out Anthony, saying the club must buy into D'Antoni's offense. After we took Stoudemire's remarks personally, Anthony said, "Not at all. Why should I do that? Coach D'Antoni got a hell of an offense. Everybody knows that around this league. It's just a matter of me picking my spot in the offense, figuring out in a timely fashion. What I told the guy is, let's be patient, man. It's not going to be 100% in 2.5 weeks. It's going to take some time." It's interesting to know that the Knicks are under 500, which, they obtained Carmelo Anthony. And when they got him, there was an awful lot of hype, and the Knicks were acting like they're going to the promised land. In all reality, the Knicks probably need one more player. But, obtaining Carmelo Anthony was definitely still the right thing. And, even though Anthony was a little frustrated, he said he didn't get as many shots as he normally does. That happens. It's nothing personal. He says he's still getting used to these guys, and these guys are getting used to me. Again, he said there was nothing personal, and he and Douglas kind of yucked it up after they watched the film. So that bears a little bit of watching. The Miami Heat are constantly using the excuse of, you know, they haven't gelled yet, so on and so forth. But, three-quarters of the season has gone by, so I'm not giving the Miami Heat any chance to use that excuse. You know, if the Knicks haven't gelled together yet, and, you know, the guy's only been there for a couple weeks, I don't have a problem with that. But, the Knicks really do need to get their acting gear, especially since they're charging a 50% increase for playoff tickets. You know, and they are going to make the playoffs, so that's pretty much guaranteed. All right, moving forward. On April 8th, the San Francisco Giants will unfurl their banner for the first World Series championship since moving to the West Coast in 1958, a title celebrated both for the long drought it ended and for the everyman quality, you know, most of the players who delivered it. Not a whole bunch of superstars there, just a lot of everyday guys and a really great pitching staff. However, less than 2 miles away, the team's biggest star of the last 40 years and baseball's all-time home run king could be fighting for his freedom. Barry Bonds' trial on 4 charges of perjury and 1 of obstruction of justice is scheduled to begin today in San Francisco with jury selection that could last 3 to 4 weeks, bumping into the March 31st start of the season. Along with a scheduled July trial of 7-time, excuse me, you got a little bit of cold, folks, 7-time Cy Young Award winner Roger Clemens, also charged with lying under oath about his involvement with steroids. And baseball will get a double-dose reminder of its sordid association with performance-enhancing drugs, even as it tries to leave that era behind. Bond's trial definitely have the makings of a compelling affair, with testimony expected from current and former players such as Jason Giambi, Benito Santiago, ex-girlfriend Kimberly Bell, who definitely has an axe to grind. She's even expected to talk about Bond's sexual dysfunction, nice, and the fits of rage, you know, both obviously linked to steroid use. In addition to a secretly taped recording of his trainer, Greg Anderson, describing how he injected Bonds with steroids. Beautiful. U.S. District Court Judge Susan Ilson said in recent hearings that she would allow those pieces of evidence to be introduced, boosting the prosecution's case. The judge had previously barred key evidence connected to Anderson, including urine samples he collected of Bonds and supposedly tested positive for steroids, because he could not be cooperated unless Anderson testified. Anderson, who previously served a year in jail in contempt of court for refusing to testify about Bonds, has reiterated his refusal and is expected to be locked up for the trial's duration. The prosecution definitely has a strong case. You have the changes in Bonds' physique, including his head size late in his career, and the Anderson recording is pretty convincing evidence. You know, anytime you have one side establishing their case right out of the mouth of the other party, that's pretty dramatic. Bonds 46 will be tried in the same courthouse where he told a grand jury in December 2003, toward the end of his 4-year streak as National League's most valuable player, that he had never knowingly taken performance-enhancing substances. That testimony, part of a federal investigation into the Bay Area Laboratory Cooperative, otherwise known as BALCO, that grew into the biggest sports doping scandal in American history, is at the heart of the case. Legal experts say it's highly unlikely Bonds will testify at this trial. I tend to agree with those legal experts. Bonds would, God, they'd just chew his ass up if he got on the stand. Being a person that works out in the gym and is generally athletic, I find it extremely hard to believe that Bonds had no knowledge that the stuff he was taking was, you know, helping him increase his performance. I mean, it's just impossible to not know. You know, when you're hitting things harder or when you're running faster or when you're lifting more, you know. And you know if it's an exorbitant amount, you know, if it's almost inhuman. So you know there's something to it. Anyway, prosecutors say Bonds knew the BALCO products, you know, much like I say. He got from Anderson known as the cream and the clear were steroids, not arthritic balm and flaxseed oil, as he testified. Exactly. To prove that, trial lawyers say they need to focus easy to discern false statements in Bond's testimony. Keep it simple so the jury can see very clearly the difference between what was stated under oath and what was the truth. One possibility could be the charge that Bonds lied when he said only doctors had injected him. In court documents, the government says Kathy Hoskins, Bonds' former personal assistant, will testify that she saw Anderson inject Bonds in the navel. Her brother Steve, a former friend and business partner of Bonds, made the secret recordings of a conversation in 2003 in which Anderson tells how he avoided infections when injecting Bonds. The defense probably figures to attack the credibility and motives of Hoskins, whom Bonds once accused of forging his baseball memorabilia, as well as Bell, who posed nude for Playboy in 2007. Anyway, this is going to be a very interesting trial. It would be even more interesting if Bonds gets on the stand. God, that would be really great. He's too smart for that, and I think his legal counsel is better than Roger Clemens. I think the Roger Clemens case in July is also going to be interesting. I think Clemens is dumb enough to get on the stand, and his legal representation thus far has been absolutely piss poor. So I would almost be willing to bet the farm that Clemens gets on the stand and just absolutely buries himself. Bonds is smarter than that. Bonds has played it pretty cool throughout. Bonds is kind of a dick, mind you, and Clemens is somewhat of a prick as well. But Bonds kind of plays the game a little bit better. Clemens has been yelling from the mountaintops how he's innocent. You don't really hear Bonds saying anything, which, you know, when you're guilty, just keep your mouth shut. That's just my opinion. But, these cases definitely bear watching. They're going to be kind of fun to watch. You know, it's a shame that it's come to this. You know, guys that were held in very high esteem, by adults as well as kids that were fans of the game, you know, are going to, you know, go to court to testify whether they used performance-enhancing drugs or whether they lied. It's just really too bad that it's come to this. My personal opinion is that probably a lot of the guys in that era, we're talking about the 90s and the early 2000s, were juicing, and that goes for pitchers as well as, you know, everyday players. If that wasn't the case, you wouldn't see all the players lining up to kiss Bonds' ass and lining up to kiss Clemens' ass because they would have no respect for those guys because they weren't using steroids. But, you know, just these guys were, is what I'm saying. So I think they all were. I think the whole league was like everybody was, you know, was juicing, in my opinion. Otherwise, they all wouldn't be lining up to kiss these guys' asses. I mean, and they do. Believe me, players have an enormous amount of respect for guys like Barry Bonds. They line up and say, what a great guy he is, you know, all-time home run king, yada, yada, yada. I mean, you know, he deserves to be in the Hall. Very rarely do you hear another player say something bad about either one of these guys. So, you know, that means something. To me, that definitely means something. Anyway, moving on. When the Mets got rid of Louis Castilla last week, I was happy to see him go. I mean, he stinks. I'm not a Mets fan, but the Mets really need to clean house to get things straightened out. And I never thought that they were going to get rid of Oli Perez, but his spring was absolutely garbage. And now a putrid chapter in Mets history was declared finished yesterday as Oli Perez joined the ranks of the unemployed. Now, the way I've been pitching, I think I haven't been doing great, Perez said moments after he was released by the Mets. There's guys doing better than me, and it's going to be the best for the team and for me. Yeah, exactly. Perez appeared in the team's clubhouse at 8:15 a.m. and began shaking hands with their players, ending a tumultuous run with the organization that gave him one of the worst contracts in baseball history. The Mets, who are hurting for money, will absorb $12 million Perez is owed for this season, confident they provided the left-hander with every opportunity to prove he belonged. You know, they were going to give, they gave him a shot at starting, couldn't handle it. Gave him a shot at relief, gave up home runs to a couple of rookies. I mean, the Mets just weren't going for it. Came in a relief appearance against the Nationals. The Mets are hoping he could reinvent himself, but it's not happened. The velocity's not there. The command's not there, according to Sandy Alderson, GM Sandy Alderson. It just wasn't going to work in a starting role, and it didn't appear as if it was going to work in a relief role anytime soon. Yikes. Perez's release came only 3 days after the team swallowed the $6 million remaining on Castillo's contract. As I said, they backed Castillo. Castillo has agreed to a minor league deal with the Phillies. Perez's fastball consistently dips, you know, into the 85 range this spring. Probably will have a harder time finding work than Castillo. The decision was based largely on fan perceptions of the player, but Perez's dismissal was purely a case of diminished skills. You know, the fans had had him with Castillo, and the Mets just couldn't justify having him around, and the Perez just couldn't do it. He just couldn't cut it. I mean, Perez was a guy that, you know, needed overpowering stuff to beat people. And, you know, once he had that injury, he lost his velocity, and he was never able to turn into a pitcher. He was still kind of that power guy, but he didn't have that same power left. So, you know, hence his wildness, and when he was in the strike zone, he was getting banged up. You know, according to my teammate, at the risk of sounding bad, this is a little bit of closure. According to Jason Bay, it kind of brings a little more finality to those scenarios. From a player's point of view, you hate to see the answer be two guys go home, but there's going to be a decision made one way or the other. Bay said if Castillo and Perez had not been released, the potential for a sideshow would have been great. Jason Bay is absolutely correct. Had those guys stuck around, they would have been in the headlines just day after day after day. You know, anytime they tried to Perez out there and he got banged up, it would have been a media frenzy. Smart move for the Mets. I would be hard-pressed to see who's going to pick Perez up. My thought was that, you know, the reason the Mets wouldn't get rid of Perez was because they were just scared to death. You know, since he's a lefty, that some other team would pick him up and that they would use him and he would be successful. But I think the Mets came to the conclusion that, you know what, even if anyone does pick him up, his skills are so eroded that he's not going to be successful. And whoever picks him up will absolutely regret it. So I think the Mets cut him, you know, with no fear whatsoever of, you know, they could care less, you know, whether the Phillies pick him up, whether the Braves pick him up, whether the Nationals pick him up. Who cares who picks him up? The Yankees, whoever. I'm not saying any of those teams are picking him up. But they're confident in the fact that, you know, whoever picks him up, you know, they're just screwing themselves. You know, I see the Phillies did pick up Castillo. They gave him a minor league deal, and, you know, maybe he'll do all right. Castillo still has some skills, but he just, you know, ever since he dropped that ball against the Yankees, it's just gotten really bad for him, you know, to be in a uniform. So, anyway, that's it for this week. Shout out to all my woodheads out there, Ron, Mark, Leo, Dino, Troy, everyone at Northeast Athletic Club, my partner, Money Mike. Hopefully we can get some warm weather, and stay tuned next week. I will give my baseball predictions. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
If we can fill in that, yeah, I think we got time.
Let's just see who
this article is.
Obama starts in another legal war. Rangel calls for the draft.
Yep.
Nobel Peace Prince. Whoops. Leo just changed that.
By Activist Post, by the way, yeah.
Okay, this is a little different beginning. This is from the Activist Post. What balls, what hubris, what hypocrisy, what happened to America? Once again, America has preemptively attacked a sovereign nation that posed no threat to her without a declaration of war from the people's representatives. Apparently, the U.S. president now gets permission from the U.N. to spend U.S. taxpayer dollars on unprovoked wars and outright murder. Isn't it still called murder when killing is not done in self-defense? Okay, just checking to make sure I haven't lost my mind. Nobel Peace Prince Obama launched his liberation of the good people of Libya with his own shock and awe bombing campaign appropriately on the 8th anniversary of Bush's illegal invasion of Iraq. This tyrannical intervention is so naked, so brazen in its hubris that whatever shred of goodwill America had left is completely gone. America is officially the most murderous, anti-democratic, terrorist nation the world has ever known. And get this, on the very same day of this unconstitutional act of war, ethically challenged Charlie Rangel reintroduced his National Service Draft Bill. Rangel pointed out in his announcement that the government lied to us in the Iraq War that ultimately resulted in the deaths of over 4,000 servicemen, with over 32,000 injured. He claims this is the reason we need a draft. Based on false pretenses of weapons of mass destruction and involvement in the 9/11 attacks, the unfunded war in Iraq has cost our nation not only $800 billion, but the lives of more than 4,400 brave American patriots. This is what Charlie Rangel says. Over 32,000 U.S. soldiers have also been seriously wounded in the war. We should have not been in the first place. It is because of these devastating statistics and the commitment of our nation must make to sharing in duty and service that I reintroduce the Universal National Service Act, commonly known as the draft bill.
Hey, do you know,
you can't make this stuff up.
Oh, he said the unfunded war in Iraq? Now, this guy's freaking brain dead. The unfunded war in Iraq has cost our nation not only $800 billion, but the lives of more than four. This guy.
You can't fight a war without funding it.
They've been funding it all along, okay? By Congress and Charlie Rangel included.
You can't make this stuff up. So our government lies us into war for profits and oil, thrusts our brave young women and men in harm's way against poor nations who in their wildest dreams couldn't threaten America, and puts off paying for them as long as the banks in China get their interest payments at gunpoint from the taxpayers. And now you want to force all our kids to take part in this sociopathic behavior?
Rangel continues, currently the burden of defending our nation is carried by an increasingly smaller segment of our population. Only 1% of the American population currently make the sacrifice of laying down life and limb for our country. Far too many are being forced into repeated tours of duty, sometimes as many as 6 deployments. Hell, they're getting paid for it. This is what they do. They're mercenaries. This repeated combat exposure to our troops is why 25% of America's active duty military personnel suffer from post-stress disorder. It is why the Army's current suicide rate is far above the civilian rate at 22 per 100,000. The rate of a Marine Corps is even higher. Right? Boy, Rangel is a first-rate salesman. Who could resist the idea of forcing their children into repeated tours of duty and a 1 in 4 chance of getting ruined by PTSD? Or making them so miserable that they think suicide is better than killing poor brown people for big oil profits and their pocket change politicians, all while bankrupting the country and their homes, towns in the process.
Rangel's pitch that a draft would alleviate these problems is ill-conceived, as he even pointed out. Having a draft does not necessarily mean that everyone called to duty would be bribed to serve in the armed forces. Who in their right mind would choose the armed forces in this corrupt imperial climate if it given a choice of community services? Of course, liberals like to think Rangel's hidden argument is that a draft would actually discourage war by making the people pay more attention to the wars enough to protest. Wake up. We can't even get Congress to vote for these wars anymore. The notion that the decision makers will actually give a shit about the people's will is laughable. Besides, we all know how they handle peaceful protests. These days, despite their lofty rhetoric of fighting for people's rights in foreign countries, at this point it seems the only thing that can stop these conquistadors is when soldiers start refusing to fight en masse. They said they alone have the power to end this insanity. And as Albert Einstein said, nothing will end war unless the people themselves refuse to go to war. God help them find the courage and the moral compass to end this tyranny.
You got it. And we have about 3 minutes before John comes on, and there was one more that I thought was interesting. And this really annoys me.
Yeah, me too.
I mean, the government, the U.S. government and Congress are working on defunding PBS, all right, and NPR, NPR,
yeah.
Actually. And yet they're giving money, they're funding the BBC, British Broadcasting Corp.
So we fund them and we don't fund our own stations.
Yeah. And the BBC World Service is to receive a significant sum of money from the U.S. government to help combat the blocking of TV and Internet services in countries including Iran and China. And what the BBC said is the first deal of its kind. An agreement is expected to be signed later this month that will see U.S. State Department money, understood to be a low six-figure sum, given to the World Service to invest in developing anti-jamming technology and software. The funding is also expected to be used to educate people in countries with state censorship in how to circumnavigate the blocking of Internet and TV services. Oh, that must be like the guys who live in the mosques there that we're paying for renovation.
Yeah.
We paid $700 million to renovate mosques in the Middle East, by the way.
It is understood that the U.S. government has decided the reach of the World Service is such that it makes investment worthwhile. The U.S. government money comes as the World Service faces a 16% cut in its actual grant from the Foreign Office, a £46 million reduction in its £236.7 million budget over 3 years that will lead to about 650 job cuts. The money will be channeled through the World Service's charitable arm, the World Service Trust. The deal, which is expected to be formally announced on International Press Freedom Day, the 3rd of May, follows an increase in incidents of interference with World Service output across the globe, according to its Controller of Strategy and Business, Jim Egan. BBC Persian Television, which launched in early 2009 and airs in Iran and its neighboring countries, has experienced numerous instances of jamming. The BBC Arabic TV news service has also been jammed in recent weeks across various parts of North Africa during the recent uprisings in Egypt and Libya. Governments who have an interest in denying people information, particularly at times of tension and upheaval, are keen to do this, and it is a particular problem right now, says Egan.
Countries like Britain and the United States, they don't give any information.
Yeah.
Right, to their countries. We're the 23rd. Most censored country out of 180, I believe, in the world, according to international journalists.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, so it's like this is complete bullshit that we have to that the United States is paying to.
And that was from the Guardian.co.uk. If you want to go to that BBC World Service to fund funding deal, to sign funding deal with the U.S. State Department.
Totally unbelievable.
And now I believe we have John Brennan on the air.
Yes.
Good evening, John. How are you?
I'm doing absolutely great. Great to be back again. Got an interesting piece of audio for you tonight, and in the interest of getting you to hear it all in the short time that I have, I'm going to pretty much go cut straight to it. The importance of this is it's from a lady called Lorraine Murray, who did a very good video. Well, she was on the video, quite a lot of it. It was a video about the depleted uranium effects on the troops in Iraq during the first Gulf War. And of course, they're still using that type of material all over the world.
That was treason, right?
Beyond Treason, yeah, was done by the Power Hour group. But she's a very credible person, and I was very surprised at what I found out, that she mentions that the earthquake that happened in Japan, the tsunami earthquake, whatever you want to call it, the earth being manipulated, may have been weaponized. And I'm just going to go straight to the audio here on this. It'll almost be a half hour, so I'm going to use my whole time up, but this may be one of the most important things I've ever played. And if you want to interrupt me at any time, just shout into the phone and I'll kill the audio, okay?
Go ahead.
Okay.
Four tectonic plates, these huge ocean plates that were all shoving each other around underneath Japan. And so it would be sort of like you or I, Alfred, trying to climb on top of a gunny sack with...
I should say she's on Exopolitics TV with Alfred Weber, so we just have to bear with the some interruptions here.
Of that gunny sack. Well, that's exactly what Japan is trying to do in this tremendously dynamic oceanic tectonic setting. It's extremely dangerous. There is an 8.5 earthquake every 5 years in Japan, or greater than 8.5. And yet all of their nuclear power plants are on the ocean in order to get cooling, tremendous amounts of cooling water for the plants. And they are sitting on subduction zones and tectonic plate margins, boundaries that are very, very dangerous. And also they have erupting volcanoes in Japan. So I put all of that in the article. It was a very interesting article to write. And lo and behold, on March 11th, 2011, just about 6 years later, my article became reality.
Now, There are a number of possibilities there. One is that the earthquake, the 9.0 or 9.1 earthquake, itself was one of the recurring earthquakes, not 8.5, but was a mega event, but in that recurring zone. The other possibility was what you and I have been exploring, and that is a series of, in fact, tectonic attacks, earthquake attacks, using the force of earthquakes as a military type attack. And we've looked at a number of earthquakes: China in 2008, Haiti in 2010, Chile in 2010, perhaps others. That possibility is that the Japan earthquake of March 2011 was in fact a military strike, a tectonic attack using HAARP or some other mechanism to trigger that earthquake. Which do you think it was?
Well, the evidence that I've gathered up to this time indicates it was not a natural earthquake. It was a modified natural earthquake. In other words, it was initiated by external energy that was not inherent to the fault zone. And this is known as tectonic warfare. And it's part of the HAARP air-based, space-based, land-based, sea-based weapon system that was secretly developed during the Cold War by the Soviet Union and the United States together. The money for the development of the secret program, which was a huge, vast amount of money, was done it was carried out under the cover of Star Wars and missile defense. And in fact, they were secretly developing this vast system to weaponize the energy that is inherent in natural processes. So first man weaponized chemical energy. That was the Chinese when they developed gunpowder to produce a shockwave that would destroy things. Then in World War II, under the Manhattan Project, man weaponized nuclear energy, which was much greater amounts of energy than chemical energy. And they produced the nuclear bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And the candles burning behind me are around a Madonna, a Japanese Madonna figurine from Nagasaki that was a gift to me. And it has the Japanese robes and clothes and style from the neck down, but the Asian woman who represents Mary has the Catholic Italian style scarf or draping over her head. And so the first nuclear weapons were dropped on a human population, were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945. Once the nuclear weapons were tested, it was found that they were pretty messy because they left a very, very politically incorrect mess behind, with lots of dead people and horrible radiation illnesses for all future generations and those who were exposed. And of course, the political backwash around the world, it was the U.S. really didn't want to do something like that again. It was very unpopular. So they immediately began, after World War II, to develop a new weapon system that would release tremendous amounts of energy for an even bigger shockwave. And what they did was develop tectonic warfare, weather warfare, mind control, missile defense, all of these very, very sophisticated applications in the HAARP weapon system. And I'd like to mention the Space Preservation Act in the House that was introduced by Congressman Dennis Kucinich in 2002, H.R. 2977, which you had a part in, and that is probably the best and most succinct document that really describes the HAARP system in a nutshell.
Right. I think that bill was actually introduced in October of 2001 and was, to my knowledge, the only piece of legislation in the U.S. Congress to date which has purported to even acknowledge and regulate the HAARP system. So
it was important for another reason, and that is that it included chemtrails,
right,
which have been politicized into laughable oblivion, or they've tried to. But I think the public is very, very concerned about chemtrails, and it was very important that that was included in that bill.
Yeah.
Because it is a part of the HAARP system.
In fact, the guest that preceded you quite recently, we had Clifford Carnicum as a guest, and his work has shown that the function of chemtrails over the last decade from 1999, all of this accelerated in the year 1999, according to his view regarding chemtrails, was that the chemtrails have functioned to turn the Earth's atmosphere into a plasma. And,
that's right.
And that the chemtrails planes that we see now are just to make sure that the plasma stays at a stable rate. And it's that plasma that the HAARP system uses as a plasma weapon.
Well, it's also an electromagnetic frequency mirror.
Right.
It reflects the HAARP transmissions as well.
Right. So now we have a modality that we've shown in other instances. And if people want to go to a particular website, it's www.peaceinspace.org. That's peaceinspace.org. And you can see the application of HAARP in triggering other similar tectonic events, that is, earthquake warfare, as I mentioned, ranging from China up till Haiti, up till Chile. What other sorts of signatures make you feel that this event was, in fact, an act of deliberate warfare, let's say, initially against Japan, but also against North America and the planet?
There are a number of them. I would start with September the 10th, 2001, the day before 9/11, when FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, that is the main responding agency for disasters in the U.S., they predicted, this is very strange, three disasters in the future. One was a terrorist event in New York City. It happened the next day on 9/11/2001. They also predicted a hurricane disaster in disaster in New Orleans. That happened 4 years later in 2005 in New Orleans with Hurricane Katrina. And I do have images of Hurricane Katrina from NASA that show an ionizing beam of energy coming down from space into the edge of Hurricane Katrina on the top. And that's how they steer hurricanes. They heat up one side of the hurricane, and they can sort of drag it around like a wand. And they drag it over warmer water if they want to increase the energy in the hurricane and make it more violent and destructive. Or they drag it over colder water, and that decreases the energy and calms down the hurricane. So there are many reasons to think that, or that we know, HAARP was used on 9/11, and HAARP was used on Hurricane Katrina. And the third prophecy or prediction by FEMA was that there would be an earthquake disaster on the West Coast. Now, whether this is the disaster they were predicting or it's one that is yet to come, it will be related to earthquakes. And certainly, I can be fairly certain that it's going to affect a nuclear power plant somewhere on the West Coast.
Now, also, we have the strange behavior of U.S. authorities. While Japan initially released the information that the March 11, 2011 earthquake was a 9.0 or a 9.1 earthquake,
before we go to that,
yeah.
I'd like to mention that Westinghouse. GE and Westinghouse nuclear power plants are the ones built in Japan. And Westinghouse was sold to Hitachi, and Toshiba would get a part of it too, in February 2006 for $5.4 billion. Now, why would Westinghouse suddenly sell be sold, actually the Rockefellers own GE and Westinghouse. Why would they sell their company to Hitachi when they had maintained it for 50 years in Japan, 60 years? It's very strange. And then in August of 2007, they sold 10% of Westinghouse, the Japanese did, to Kazakhstan for $540 million. And so this is beginning to smell a lot like Rockefellers and the Clintons and the Bushes and this criminal cabal of politicians, military-industrial complex, and energy that is really creating havoc all over the world. And, of course, they're the ones who are using HAARP and benefiting from HAARP. So I think there's more and more evidence when you really look at many facets of this that indicate this was a HAARP event. Go ahead with your comments about the earthquake intensity.
Yeah,
or
well,
shall I answer?
We have the anomaly that the Japanese came out initially saying that it was a 9.0 earthquake, but the U.S. came out initially saying it was a 6.7 earthquake, which is, you know, totally false, although they were reporting it both on the same from the same set of sensors worldwide. Was the U.S. trying to hide something?
Well, certainly, I noticed immediately that Japan, and I know a lot of Japanese scientists and seismologists and geologists, and I noticed that immediately after the earthquake, Japan stated it was a 9.0 or a 9.1. That intensity has never been reported in Japan in the last 150 years of monitoring and studying earthquakes and the intensity of earthquakes. So there was another flag that this was an off-scale event which hadn't been reported before. And then I noticed that the U.S. began reporting it was a 6.7, a 7.1, then a 7.3. And what was most puzzling to me is that the International Seismic Network, with stations all over the world, is shared by all countries. And so the U.S. and Japan would have been analyzing the same data and yet coming up with very different answers, although Japan never changed their assessment from 9.0 or 9.1. So then it went from 7.3 that the U.S. was reporting, then they changed it to 7.9. Finally, they changed it to 8.9, but charging 99 cents for something instead of a dollar, it seemed like it was a psychological attempt to downplay or minimize the intensity, the unusual intensity of this earthquake. And finally, just more than a week after that earthquake, they finally said it was a 9.0. That is very, very strange. I know USGS, the United States Geological Survey, very well. They're very, very good scientists there, and they would not do that. It would be a politicized scientific assessment rather than a scientist presenting what his estimate was based on scientific data. Someone above him in the administrative area was changing the intensity for political purposes. It was not the scientist.
Today in Canada, we were listening to a very interesting radio program with an 82-year-old retired English professor in Hiroshima who was actually an Ibakusha himself also. He was a survivor of the atomic bomb. And they asked him, well, what do you think of this event? He said, I think it was the third atomic bombing of Japan. And that was from the words. And in fact, you have come across data that show that this event is about the power of a million nuclear bombs dropped on that area of Japan. I wonder if you could explain that to us.
Yes. What I did was I contacted Marion Folk, who was a Manhattan Project scientist in World War II, and he later became involved in the nuclear weapons program at Los Alamos in Livermore and worked at Livermore the last 20 years of his career. He actually is the one who solved the problems on the hydrogen bomb. In other words, the mathematicians and the physicists who were involved could not make it work. Marion Falk sat down and solved all the problems, and he is responsible for the success of the creation of the U.S. hydrogen bomb. So I called him up. He's my best friend. He's 90 years old. He's taught me everything I know and the philosophy of things and how to speak correctly, how to educate the public with the truth. And he started 10 years ago and has spent a lot of time with me. He said, I never supported atmospheric testing. I don't think anybody outside of a nuclear power plant should get exposed to radiation from the plant or from the bombs. And you will be my spokesman for the rest of your life, my spokesperson. So I've been to 50 countries in the last 10 years speaking about this. And I called him up and I said, Marion, how much energy was released in this bomb? And I'm sorry, in this earthquake. And he sat down and spent about 2 days calculating, and he came up with an answer. And he said, I used the amount of energy that was released by the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs. Together, it was about 30 kilotons, which means it was the energy that would be released by an equivalent 30,000 tons of TNT or dynamite. And he calculated the amount of energy in joules. It was 132 times 10 to the 18th joules. That would be for a 9.0 earthquake. And that is the equivalent of a million 31 kiloton bombs, nuclear bombs, which is the combined yield of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And so that is exactly what tectonic warfare and HAARP is about. They are using the energy that they can trigger the release of in nature, and it creates a huge shock wave and does tremendous damage and kills a lot of people. And so how could you drop a million atomic bombs on Japan and get away with it? It would be impossible. But you could trigger an earthquake silently, invisibly. No one even knows it. They think it's a natural event. And you're releasing more energy than you could ever release in a weapon, from a weapon, an atomic weapon. And it's the equivalent of a million nuclear bombs. So not only that, this is a very, very complex, interlocking, interrelated fault zone. It's where two plates are colliding. So you have tremendous stresses, tremendous amounts of energy stored up in every part of that, every fault line in that system of faults, on echelon faults. And so once that one was triggered, every fault in that system has to adjust to the change in the stress and the strain. And so we are sure to have another major earthquake in this zone, as well as the minor quakes. I don't think 6 and 7 are so minor, though, But this earthquake zone will be adjusting itself for a number of months to come. And Marion Falk pointed out there's sure to be at least a magnitude 7 to 8 earthquake ahead of us.
I'm going to cut the audio there on this because we've got 5 minutes left.
Thank you very much, John. That was very informative. Do you have any idea why, if what she proposes is true, why they would target Japan for an earthquake and nuclear disaster?
I have a fairly good idea why they do it. I've been following what the New World Order's plans are. Basically, at this stage, for some reason, I don't know the reason why they would do it. They're trying to send our entire civilization back into a pre-industrial stage. There's even, you'll hear stories on NPR where they're tearing down highways across the United States. They want to get us out of our cars. They're weaning us off everything. We've peaked as a civilization in the elite's opinion. They're weaning us off, and they're sending us back on the downward slope now, back to the Amish style of life, perhaps. And don't forget that Japan is the most advanced civilization on our planet. They were all the cars, the electronics, everything comes from Japan. What better way to kick off the downward slope of our civilization than to take that one out of the picture? Does that make sense?
It certainly does.
And as she said, there's a lot more coming. When they decided to use an event and an energy, the energy would be, some people refer to it as the ether in the atmosphere. She explained that originally, you know, we started off with bullets and gunpowder. It's gone high-tech in a big way. You've got the satellites, laser, ELF, all sorts of frequencies. The control is almost like it's aliens running the planet. However, they have robotic systems, as I've said before, that are quite capable of replacing most of the needs of the human worker. You know, they don't need us anymore. I don't know if I phrased that right.
Right.
So for some reason, they appear to be kind of pulling the plug on us as a civilization. They're sending us back to a very low style of life, back to the land, and it's even questionable if the land will be usable anymore if all this radiation and the chemicals they use in the chemtrails is falling all over the planet. So I still have some pieces in the jigsaw puzzle to try and analyze and put together. So I will try and get that together another night, but I wanted to at least play this audio that I did tonight to let you hear right from sort of the horse's mouth. Lorraine Murray, you know, is a lady who has, you know, as she said, done about 20 speaking tours in Japan. She's been basically all over the world. She talked to the parliament over there. She's been warning about the nuclear plants, and there's a nuclear reprocessing plant in the north of Japan. It was called Rikosho, and she basically warned them about that, not to use it. She, like I said, she got to meet a lot of the engineers over in Japan who, it turned out, were whistleblowers on the nuclear industry, and they gave her many details about hidden problems in these nuclear facilities. But that's neither here nor there now. They obviously have been betrayed. And as you heard from her in the beginning, the Rockefellers, the Clintons, all of these elites are high up on the scale of the ownership of these plants.
I guess so, huh?
Mm-hmm. So they have an agenda. We have to figure it out. But
well, John, I was just looking up the Illuminati card game.
Yeah, Steve Jacobson, very interesting. What is on there? I haven't looked at that lately. That's a good point.
Combined disasters. You may
what
combine,
is it?
Combined disasters.
Combined disasters, yeah.
Combined,
yeah. Yeah. I'm going to go online and look at it up right now. Yeah, You've probably spoken about what that is to your listeners before.
Yeah, Illuminati card game. Yeah, it's got cards on all of the things that are, that the Illuminati has planned, events that are planned.
And it came out before 9/11. It was around 1995, and it had towers like the Twin Towers with planes crashing into them, and the Pentagon is one of the cards with a plane crashed into it.
This combined disasters. I'm looking at it. It says the same place as long as both are eligible to play. Okay, one disaster to be the main one, followed by the instruction of the card. Okay.
Well, this is it right here.
Yeah.
The most. Let me just read the most. What most of the Mother Earth worshippers do not realize is that the Illuminati, the most powerful of the Gaia group, has achieved scientific control of the weather and all the natural disasters with which man has been contending for several thousands of years.
Wow.
If Illuminati controls the functions of Mother Gaia, weather disasters, they can use natural disasters in order to achieve their draconian plans without very many people thinking to blame them. Since the Illuminati plans to reduce the population of the world by 66%, the same percentage of population reduction in the Book of Revelations, they plan to rewild, which is what you're talking about, much of the continents of the world. Rewild
right.
is defined as a major effort to clear land of humans and let the land go back to the wild.
Yeah,
that's right, and maybe have a few percentages of us go back and under their, like slaves on the land, I suppose. Again, one of the questions that a lot of people would ask here would be, well, if the radiation fallout and all that kills us, wouldn't it kill those people as well? And well, interesting.
No, here they have a hurricane card and early warning, right?
Mm.
And then they have top 10 hurricanes that were caused by them. Then they have a volcano. Remember the one in Iceland and the ones now in Hawaii and all over?
Right.
All right.
It's all on the cards.
It's right there on the card. And then they got meteor strike. We haven't gotten that one yet.
And they might not be real meteors either. So, you know, what can look like a meteor strike, I didn't want to get into that subject. But, yeah, I think that is something that's going to be an occurrence in the future. And I'm not going to even try and guess when these guys will attempt to do that one. It would be 5 years.
I'm looking right at this card, and it says tidal wave.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so
right.
that's another thing they're planning. All right, and then I've got okay. So if you want to check this one out, you can go to this one happens to be Cutting Edge, the Smoking Gun, Cutting Edge Ministries. I had David Bay on the show a couple times.
Did that article that you're reading, or did you just happen to stumble upon that today? Or because I'm surprised. I actually, that's very very interesting that you came up with this card game.
No, you know what I did is all I did is I put in a Yahoo Illuminati card game.
Yeah.
And it came. And it was the first one that. I'm bookmarking it right now. It was the first one that came up. And it said. So what is it doing?
Well, I'm just kind of saying I knew about it, but I hadn't thought to check it. And compare it to this event. Certainly in 9/11, I did compare it, and certainly at Katrina when that happened, it has not occurred to me, so I'm very glad you brought this up. One of the reasons people might say, well, it's just coincidence. It's a heck of a coincidence when a lot of events appear on these cards. Why would they put these things on the cards, or why would somebody... Well, what I'm about to say might sound strange to people, and believe me, I'm not the religious type. I was an altar boy, but that's a long time ago. I don't go to church anymore. But what I have discovered, there is something called the Church of Satan in this country. There's Anton LaVey. You can check that out. A lot of the things that go on are connected to something called Luciferian theology. There are people out there who follow a different God than we do. You know, they believe in... You know, the fallen angels, the Lucifer people, the Luciferans, they exist whether you want to believe it or not, and they are sort of in control right now. It's the best way I can put this in a very short time that I have here on the radio. They're carrying out events all the time, and one of the main, it's kind of like brownie points. It's part of like their, I wouldn't say kosher. They have a kind of a guide they like to tell you in advance what they're going to do. And it's almost like saying to us, we're telling you, and you're so stupid, you still can't see it. And they've put it out, you know, using the internet, of course, since that came out, but it's been done before the internet. And this is why you will find these things that are, and it's not the Nostradamus type stuff. These are definitely events that are bunching up right now. We're maybe the whole 2012 thing is put out by those people. I don't know, but they're certainly making it happen.
Well, you know, John, this would be something we could talk about more next week, and we've come, unfortunately, right to the end of our show. And we really appreciate the audio that you played. It was very informative, and I'm sure we'll have more to talk about in that regard next week.
Yes, I'm glad I was able to just stumble upon that tonight, and you know, glad everybody could hear us. It's really great that you guys do a show like this, because I hope there are hundreds of thousands of people around the world listening to this. And whether you think we're crazy or not, sooner or later you're going to find out the events that we've just spoke about, and Lorraine Murray spoke about, are as real as rain, as they say.
Well, let's talk more about it next week, and we thank you very much for being with us.
And for everybody listening, Illuminati card game.
Yeah, very great, great, really worth a look.
Take care, Johnny.
Okay, Lila, and all the listeners, thanks for tuning in tonight to the LA Steel Talk Show.
Okay, good night, John.
Okay, goodbye.
And we thank you all for being with us tonight. And we'll hope you'll be with us tomorrow, Wednesday, for news, and Thursday for Leo, and not this Friday, but the following Friday with George. And thanks for being with us, and good night.